The Laura Murphy Show, episode 53.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Laura Murphy Show. I'm Bob Murphy, and with me, as is typical, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things in Nashville?
They are very good, Bob. Thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing you this coming weekend at the Mises Institute event.
Yes, that's right, folks. If you're hearing this and you have time to respond, on Saturday, April 14th, Carlos and I are both going to be speaking for the Mises Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. And so if you want to come to that, you can go to Mises.org and then their events tab and you can see the information there. Or we'll put something at the show notes page here for the Laura Murphy Show episode 53. Also, while we're talking about scheduling, Carlos, we should probably reiterate that you and I and David Stearns are going to be putting on a presentation, a seminar on IBC for the general public. That's going to be Saturday, May 19th, and we're in 2018 right now, and that's going to be in near Chicago. For those in that area, you can come check it out. The details for that are at ibcseminar.com. Carlos, do you want to make a plug for all of the teeming fans out there as to why they should go to these events?
Well, I just think it's very important that if people are interested in fully immersing themselves in IBC, the IBC seminar is the seminar to go see. And it's almost a direct takeoff of the case for IBC, our brand new book. Obviously, at the seminar, we get into a lot of interesting details and actually show, you know, what IBC looks like working in a situation. So, I would really advise people to come and attend.
Yep. So, again, folks, for the Mises event, go to Mises.org and then their event tab and you can see the information for the Nashville. And just to be clear, that's just more like Austrian economics, libertarianism, whereas the specifically IBC event, that's going to be in Chicago in May. And for that, you go to ibcseminar.com. So for today's episode, we are returning to our series going through our new book, The Case for IBC, that Carlos and I co-authored with Nelson Nash. And that is at thecaseforibc.com. We're sending these people all over the place, but it's good stuff, folks. We're doing it because we care. And so now we are up to chapter 5 of the book. And Carlos and I were looking at this thing before we started recording. We realized there's a lot of material in chapter 5. So the title of it is, How Does This Work? The Economics of IBC. And so at this point in the book, we've explained the problem that the business owner and the typical household faces. We've explained the sense in which a dividend-paying whole life policy is a pretty good, some might say perfect, in quotation marks, investment in the sense that it hits just about all of the criteria you'd want in an ideal investment, and its deficiencies. You know, it's only deficient on a few criteria, and even there, it's not that bad on those ones. And so just it's a well-rounded Swiss Army knife, if you will, in terms of having something. And that's not even talking about IBC. And then we get into in chapter 4, we talked about, that was the one we had Nelson on, and we talked about the idea of becoming your own banker and how do you use one of these dividend paying whole life policies in for cash flow management purposes. And earlier in chapter 3, we had talked about banking versus life insurance. And, you know, why is it that the idea of banking involves a life insurance policy? So now we're up to chapter 5. How does this work? So what we're doing here is kind of coming at it from the perspective of just economics to explain some of these things and also to handle a bunch of objections. So that's what we're doing in this chapter. Now that the reader by this point in the book has been introduced to IBC and has been told that this is the way to solve the problem facing the business owner and household in previous chapters. Now we're kind of pausing to say, okay, we know you're skeptical or you have a lot of concerns or doubts. Let's try to answer them. And so here we get into some more of the economics of it, like economically speaking, how do these policies work? How can some of your earlier claims make any sense? You know, that's what we're doing in this chapter. But because the chapter has so much material, we're actually going to break this chapter up into two episodes. So right now, episode 53, we're going to handle a few of the questions. In the next episode, episode 54, we're going to tackle the ones about, hey, you guys are so worried about the economy, or let's say that I don't like fiat money and I don't like what the Fed's been doing with QE. Why would I get into life insurance? That seems crazy. Those kind of questions, which we get all the time, we're actually going to defer until next episode. We'll devote an entire episode just to those particular concerns. This one, though, we're hitting some other things that are in chapter 5. So why don't we dive right in? First one that we'll tackle here, and we get this all the time. People email and they say, hey, I'm in my 50s. I'm guessing this doesn't make sense for me, right? Or, hey, I'm in my 60s and this doesn't make sense, I'm sure. Or we get other people who say, yeah, this would make sense if I were older and had a real job, but right now I'm just out of school and, you know, I'm paying down my student loans and I don't really make that much money. So clearly this is it. So here we're here to tell you that that's incorrect. That kind of mentality that IBC can work for anybody. Now, to be sure, the way you would implement it depends on your own particular circumstances. And that's why the most Carlson I can do here is give you the big picture, give you some general principles. Ultimately, once you decide you want to bite the bullet and get one of these policies for yourself, you're going to go to our finder and, you know, look up somebody there. So that's at infinitebanking.org/finder. And you'll see, you know, the practitioners who've been through our training program. Because again, with this stuff, to tailor to your unique circumstances, you're going to need somebody, a financial professional who's been trained in this way of thinking and how to structure these policies. So we're not saying it's a one size fits all thing. What we're saying is these policies are flexible enough that they can be tailored based on your circumstances. So yes, if somebody's in his or her 60s and they have a bunch of assets built up, then they might do one sort of thing and try to, you know, move money over in a certain way to build up a policy really fast. If somebody's really young, then probably what they're going to do is get a fairly modest policy where they're not contributing too much and they build the thing up. And they might even have what's called a term rider appended to it because they're going to need that term protection early on, especially if they're married and have young kids and so on. So yes, there's all sorts of moving parts and different ways you can tailor it. But don't think that IBC only makes sense for a certain demographic. That's not true. In fact, so you might say, hey, I have a heart condition, so clearly I can't get life insurance, so it must not be for me. Nope, even that's not right, because you can take out a life insurance policy on somebody else, you know, so someone else is the insured party, as long as you have an insurable interest in the person. So it could be a child, a spouse. It could be a grandchild, or if you're a business partner with somebody, you can take out a life insurance policy on your business partner, because if that person were to go, that would, you know, affect your business, so you have an insurable interest. So there's all sorts of ways you can open up a life insurance policy, even if it's not on yourself, and you can still be the owner of the policy. You're still paying the premiums. You're still able to borrow against it and so forth. And so you can go ahead and implement IBC, even if the policy's not on yourself. All right, so the point is, there's lots of different ways you can do this. There's a lot of flexibility, which is why if you're interested, again, we encourage you, you know, once you listen to our podcasts and read the book and you know what you're doing, you understand the principles, you then go talk to a financial professional to see what would this look like in my particular circumstances.
Yes, Bob, and what I would like to add to that is that not just your 60s, you can be in your 70s and even your 80s and still do this, because I think the most important critical point you're making is the owner of the policy is going to be the individual who's making the premium payments. The insured can be someone else, someone that you have an insurable interest with, you know, whether it's a child, grandchild, even a business partner. You know, these are all people that you have an insurable interest in, and you're able to get a policy on their lives, and you make the premium payments, and so you're in control. Now, the reason I think, Bob, that a lot of people disqualify themselves from being able to do IBC is especially the older folks that say, well, you know, the way I understand life insurance works is you've got to get it early in life and then let the policy build up, and it takes a long time to build up the policy. And so that's more for young folks. And again, the young folks are saying, hey, I don't have a whole lot of money, and I got children, so I can see the term might be appropriate for me. But as far as getting one of these whole life policies, you know, that's a much more expensive proposition for me. So you're right. You know, you hear it from the young, you hear it from the old. One thing I would want to say is to keep in mind that in becoming your own banker, and what we're trying to point out in the book is that you're wanting to move away from the conventional, you know, commercial banking system that's out there and create your own alternate bank. And so for the reasons we've already discussed, and so there are older people, of course, that may see the benefits of IBC. And once they understand that it doesn't have to be them, even that they may be uninsurable, they have maybe a son or a daughter that they can insure. Obviously, the premium payments are going to be less, I don't want to call them expensive, but there's a less cash flow outlay to set one of those up. And they are the insured. But it is this senior citizen who's now going to be employing this and managing it. And this individual may have money working somewhere else. And he may see the benefits of IBC. And in order to start his own banking policy, he could actually consider maybe moving, you know, some of this this money. And it could be a significantly large amount of money into an IBC policy. Now, we have to be careful about how that's done, because you have to have certain licenses. And this is why we advocate that you use a financial professional that's been trained to do this and is properly licensed to do that. But in that sense, the senior citizen wouldn't have to be worried about building up cash value. He's simply moving a large pile of money from where it is now into an IBC policy, you see. So you have that aspect of it as well. It's not one of starting out making premium payments on a year-by-year basis, waiting until the cash value gets up to a certain point, and then at that point you can begin to start banking with it. So these are some of the things that initially people seem to misunderstand about IBC. IBC is an alternate bank, we keep calling it. It's a cash flow management system. And if you keep seeing it in that sense, you have a better way of understanding that, okay, I need, in order to get my own bank going, it doesn't necessarily have to be on my life. It can be on the life on someone else that has an insurable interest with me.
Yep, exactly so. And as Carl said there, I mean, we're not just speaking hypothetically. Like, we know real people who are in their 60s and 70s getting, you know, these policies going. So this is you know, a real thing for older folks. Don't assume that, oh, you missed the window. All right, why don't we move on to another concern we often see, especially like on the internet when you Google around and look at this stuff. And you'll see some people criticizing whole life policies, or more generally permanent life insurance policies. And they'll say, oh, it looks all fine and good, and they're showing you your cash value and the death benefit. But guess what, folks? When you die, those sneaky insurance companies only give your estate or your beneficiary the death benefit. They keep the cash value for themselves. Make sure you realize that. Okay, so first of all, yes, make sure you realize that. That is true, that if you're looking at an illustration – and it says, oh, if I were this age and then I were to die that year, and it's listing a cash value and the death benefit, don't think you're getting both. You're just getting the death benefit. But that's not something sneaky on the part of the insurance company. When you understand what the cash value is, then it's totally understandable why that's the outcome. So I think we've touched on this in a previous episode. Certainly, if you get the book, The Case for IBC, we spell it out more carefully in a previous chapter. But what the cash value is, that's short for cash surrender value. So what that's saying is, if for some reason you wanted to get out of the policy beforehand while you're still alive, it's not just that you're out of luck, right? If you say, you know what, I don't want to keep making these premium payments anymore, depending on how far along you've been into the policy, you're going to get a cash surrender value, like a sort of, you know, walking away money. And so, and that can be quite sizable, and that's all spelled out contractually when you first sign into the policy. It gives you, you know, targets over time saying at these milestones, this is how much we're guaranteeing what the cash surrender value would be. And then in practice, they might pay you dividends, you know, if the company performs better and so forth. So that's what the cash surrender value is. It's sort of an anticipation of that future death benefit. So it's like the life insurance company, they're taking premium payments from you. They're, quote, putting them to work, investing in assets, because they know at some point this person could die and then we owe the beneficiary, you know, the state of death benefit. And so we have to be investing these premiums. And so in a sense, it's like the life insurance company is accumulating this stockpile of assets that's earmarked to back up your policy. So I'm speaking loosely, but I just want, you know, you listeners to get the gist of it, get the intuition behind it. And so if the policyholder now cancels, well, then all of a sudden the life insurance company has this huge potential liability that's removed from their books, right? In a sense, you're like a ticking time bomb to them. At some point, you're going to die, and then they're going to owe somebody the death benefit. And so if you now say, you know what, I want out, well, then that's a relief on their part. And so now, you know, they're in a much better financial position because they don't have this liability anymore in their books. And they've been carrying these assets all along, getting ready to pay your death benefit. So now if you want out, they have this, in a sense, extra money sitting there, these extra assets. And so that's why they would have the ability to give you a cash payment for you to walk away. So that's what the cash surrender value is. For the purists out there, the wonks, technically what it is in terms of, you know, the actuarial definition, it's the actuarially expected present discounted value of the future death benefit minus the remaining future premium payments. Okay, so that's why the cash, I realize I said that fast, and if you're at the gym or something, you might not have caught that, but if you really care and want to know the technicalities, that's what it is. And so what that means is, you think about it, the life insurance company knows they got to pay you a death benefit, but it's in the future and it's uncertain. They don't know when. So that makes, you know, the present value of that future payoff lower in their mind because of its uncertainty and its distance in the future. And also, in order for you to get there, you have to pay them your premium payments. So in a sense, every time you get through another year, let's say, that looming death benefit is closer in time. And you've gone through one or more premium payments, depending on how frequently you pay them. And so that's why the cash value increases over time, is because the amount of money you need to pay the life insurance company to keep the thing in force keeps getting lower. And the present value of that death benefit payment keeps getting bigger and bigger as that, you know, as your death approaches. We don't know when you're going to die, but every year that passes, we know your death is 1 year closer. Okay. So that's why actuarially, in terms of the accounting, that as time passes and you keep your policy in force, the amount the life insurance company would be willing to pay you to walk away gets bigger and bigger. And of course, you know, just as an aside, that cash surrender value that keeps getting bigger, that's the basis, that's the collateral upon which they'll give you policy loans. So the cash surrender value is important to you as the policy owner for IBC purposes, even if you're never planning on surrendering. And in fact, as Carlos and I will say repeatedly throughout this series, generally speaking, you never want to surrender one of these things. It would take a, you know, weird set of circumstances where we would think that's the right thing to do. But we're just saying, the definition, the cash value, that's where it comes from. So having said all that, now just step back, get a deep breath. Of course, if the cash surrender value is like the anticipation of that future death benefit, if you actually happen to die, well, then they're just going to give you the death benefit. They're not going to give you the cash value on top of that. That wouldn't make any sense. The cash value, in a sense, is what they're paying you now is the present spot value of that much bigger future death benefit. So it's a lower amount because they don't owe you the death benefit if you're still alive. So why would they pay you the full thing? But you know, you're just saying, you know what? If I want to walk away, just get, how much would you give me right now instead of waiting for me to die and giving me the big death benefit years down the road? They'll give you a number that's going to be lower. But if you happen to die, then they owe you the full death benefit right now. So again, they wouldn't give you the cash value on top of that. The analogy we use in the book, imagine you're paying mortgage payments. You know, you have a house and you got a 30-year mortgage. And then every month you're making your mortgage payments and your CPA could tell you that you're building up equity in the house with each payment. So imagine 30 years go by, you finally knock out that last mortgage payment. And then you go to your bank and you say, yep, I paid off my mortgage. And they say, congratulations, Mr. Jones, here's the deed to your house. And let's say the house is worth $300,000. You say, great, thanks, I got the deed. And now I would like my $300,000 in equity, please. And the banker says, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, yeah, because every time I was making a payment, my CPA was showing me how much equity I had in the house, and it was building up to 300 grand. And now that I just cleared that last mortgage payment and there's no lien on the house anymore, my CPA tells me I have a full $300,000 in equity in this house, so I'd please like my check for that. And the banker, of course, would say, no, you misunderstood what the CPA was telling you. He meant, here's the value of the house, and then the mortgage that's left is like a lien on that. Now that you knocked out the mortgage, the house is yours free and clear. It's not that we owe you something on top of that. Okay, so that's kind of the analogy, that if you thought when you died that the life insurance company owes you not only the death benefit, but the cash value also, that would be the same kind of confusion. That in a sense, it's like the cash value is what you have free and clear, where you don't have the lien of the, you know, the future premium payments and the fact that the, you know, the death benefits in the distant, in the future and uncertain. Okay. So not, you know, not 100% perfect analogy, but I hope you at least can get what I'm saying. The type of confusion that would be on the part of the person thinking the commercial bank not only owed him the deed to the house, but also the quote equity is a check on top of that. That kind of confusion is what would happen for somebody who thought the life insurance company, when he died, should pay the beneficiary not only the death benefit, but also the quote cash value that was in the policy. No, the way these things are designed is when they mature, like at age 121 now for policies in the US, if you look at a standard illustration, the cash value gets bigger and bigger over time until it hits the death benefit at age 121. So that's kind of showing that the way these things are constructed actuarially, it's that the cash value rises anticipating that future death benefit until the point at which the policy matures. If you still happen to be alive at 121, they just go ahead and give you the full value right then. So the cash value has reached and, you know, met the official death benefit, which is why the policy completes. So at any earlier time, the cash value is a lower number because it's just, again, in anticipation of that still looming future death benefit. Anything you want to add to that exposition, Carlos?
Well, no, I've always been mystified by this question when it comes up, Bob, and it comes up quite often. And I can think, why do people think that they're going to get the death benefit and the cash value? Why do they keep thinking that? It doesn't seem that it would even come up as a question, but it does come up until I started realizing that there's a lot of gurus on the internet, even on radio broadcast shows. That's how they pose it. That's exactly how they say it. Hey, you don't want to do one of these things because you know what? You know, they only give you the death benefit. They don't give you the cash value. So they actually are dissuading people from doing IBC because the gurus themselves are thinking, no, you should get the death benefit and the cash value. So what you're explaining there, Bob, is correct. I mean, you don't get both. Now, approaching it from a businessman or as an investor into something, you know, when you do IBC, you're not investing, of course. That's not what you're doing. But if you are an investor, one of the things you pay attention to it is the exit strategy. How do I get out of this investment if I'm not happy with it? You know, and when you talk about the cash surrender value that's in the policy that you're able to see in the illustration, where the life insurance company is saying, if you want to get out of this thing in year 10, year 5, this is how much the life insurance company will pay you on the spot if you want to exit out of it. Now, from a business and a businessman standpoint, this makes a lot of sense. You know, I don't have to keep doing this. Maybe I don't like this anymore. How do I get out? Well, you can get out. And this is how much money you get from getting out. So, again, I keep emphasizing, if you look at this thing, IBC, as a cash flow management system, it starts to make sense, much more sense, how this cash value works, how the death benefit works. And as Bob, as you were saying, you may make a few premium payments, you know, when you get one of these things. But if you happen to die, they're going to pay you the whole entire death benefit, you know, right there on the spot. So that's one part of it. But obviously, you wouldn't have very much cash value in it at that point either. But you only get the one. You get the death benefit, or if you exit out of it, you get the cash surrender value.
Yes, and that's, I'm glad you put it that way, because that leads into the last thing that we wanted to cover in this particular episode, is the question of, why the heck would I get one of these whole life policies? I always heard that you're supposed to buy term and invest the difference. And so you're right, Carl, that in that sort of exposition, I think that's what leads people to think that something fishy is going on with these whole life policies, because in this standard exposition, what they'll do is they'll say, hey, instead of you buying a whole life policy, or even more generally, any kind of permanent life insurance, they'll say, look, at what's going on there is it's kind of blending pure life insurance coverage with an investment side fund. That's the way the critic would explain it. And so look at, I can outperform on both counts. So look at, instead of you paying, you know, what's the premium that this guy's telling you should pay for your whole life policy for a given death benefit? And the person says, okay, you know what? I'll take that same number. I'll get you a term life insurance policy with the same death benefit that they were going to set you up with. So we're doing apples to apples. This is what the critic like Dave Ramsey or Susie Orman would say. And then guess what? Look at the premium to get a term policy. Like, let's say it's a 20-year term policy with the same death benefit. The premium is much lower on that policy than it is on the whole life policy with the same death benefit. So we'll go ahead, we'll lock in that life insurance. We got that now taken care of. And then with the savings, because the premium's lower, we'll now start contributing on the side to a mutual fund, you know, a diversified fund that's in the S&P 500 or whatever. Even put some bonds in there if you're more conservative. Okay. And then we'll just keep doing that. And now we'll just track the performance of these two strategies over time. And so they think that they've, you know, accounted for the life insurance being equivalent, so they don't even look at that anymore. And then they're just tracking the growth in the cash surrender value on the whole life policy as against the market value of this mutual fund. And so they're going to, you know, with standard assumptions and looking back at past performance and saying, this particular mutual fund over the last 20 years performed such and such, so we'll assume that's true going forward. Oh, and look at that compared to the paltry whole life policy, the cash surrender value is growing quite modestly there. And so over time, the amount you have in your mutual fund side investment is bigger than the cash surrender value. And if you happen to die at any point, you get the same death benefit either way. Right. And so that's the way they'll do it. And then they'll say, also notice with the buy term and invest the difference, if you die, not only does the term policy pay the death benefit, but your estate still has whatever that mutual fund was. Whereas they say, you know, they stress with the whole life policy, keep in mind you're, quote, losing the cash value if you die. Okay, so that's where, you know, you're right, Carlos, these so supposed gurus telling people about their money when they want to disparage whole life and say only a fool would put his money in that kind of a thing, instead buy term and invest the difference. That's, I think, where this comes from, because if they're separating the two things out, yeah, it is true. If you die and you had a term policy in force, any of your other investments don't automatically go away. Whereas with the whole life policy, that they, it's not that the cash value goes away. It's that what that was, you know, an option you had built into the policy, but the death benefit supersedes that. Okay. So why don't we go ahead and, you know, we can do this fairly quickly because we're already near the end of our time for this episode. Let me just remind people, if you want to see us do an in-depth play-by-play, point-by-point, taking down this standard argument for buy term and invest the difference, we devoted not one, not two, but three entire podcast episodes to that topic. It was way back in episodes 4, 5, and 6 of the Laura Murphy Show, where we, again, systematically dismantle this standard objection. But for our purposes right now, just a few points. That number one, and most important, it's not apples to apples. And there's two different ways of seeing there. There's two components to why they don't do apples to apples, even though they lead you to believe that's what they're doing. So one thing is, whether it's Dave Ramsey or whoever, they'll say, oh, you want life insurance? Okay, yeah, we'll get you a 20-year, or maybe they'll even say a 30-year term policy with the same death benefit. And they think, therefore, they've handled the life insurance part on equivalent terms. But no, they haven't. A whole life policy is a life policy that's in place for your whole life. That's where the name comes from. And so, you know, the other way, once that term policy expires, even if you're in good health, for sure the premium's going to go up. But if you've developed a condition in the interim, you might not even be insurable anymore. Okay, so it's entirely not apples to apples. And the way I get people to see this is, go ahead and keep the death benefit the same. Just look at term policies. You can do this like with an online calculator or, you know, quote generator, and just go ahead and put your information in that it needs, and then see what the policy is for a 5-year term policy, for a 10-year term policy, for a 20-year, for a 30-year. And as you increase the length of the term, the premium's going to go up. And why is that? Well, duh, because the longer you build in the term, that means you're the older you're going to be on the tail end of that thing, and the more likely you are to die, right? So if you're a 25-year-old and you just take out a 10-year term policy, the level annual premium is going to be a certain number. If instead you take out a 30-year term policy, the premium they quote you is going to be higher, right? Because you're going to end up being older by the time that thing expires. And so they need to take that into account. There's a much bigger chance of you dying on the tail end of that. So if they're going to charge you the same premium for every year, obviously, that number's got to be bigger the longer the term is. Okay, well, if you're 21 years old and you take out a whole life policy, that's effectively a 100-year term policy, right? Because that thing's going to be in force up through age 121, at which point it'll mature if you're still alive. And so if you run the numbers, just think about that. Of course, they got to charge you a higher premium because there's that built-in continuation value. They can't just kick you off and say you got to reapply the way the life insurance can with a term policy. One way of seeing it is with conventional term policies, the life insurance company knows they're most likely not going to pay a dime on that because you're probably going to live through it and the policy is going to expire without them having paid off on it. So that's why they can afford, statistically speaking, to charge you such a low amount, because they know most people taking out term policies don't die and don't get paid off. There's nothing shady about that. I mean, that's how term insurance works. That's fine. But my point is, it's crazy to look at the difference in premiums between a whole life policy and a term and think that there's something shady going on. No, it's because the whole life policy is such a much more robust product. The life insurance company is offering you a lot more, which is why they have to charge more for it. The last thing, let me just say, Carlson, and I know I'm monopolizing this here. The other thing is, when Dave Ramsey, for example, when he walks through his standard demonstration to try to show you why whole life's a bad investment, he'll say, oh, invest the difference, put it in a mutual fund. Well, that mutual fund is exposed to the stock market. So when he comes up with what he thinks is the normal rate of return on that side mutual fund, keep in mind that's a very volatile figure. You know, those kind of funds could have lost 40% in 2008, 2009. Whereas the whole life policy, the cash value that's growing at an admittedly modest pace over time, it can't go backwards. And there are guarantees built into it. So yes, of course, the amount the life insurance company is going to guarantee you and say, you keep this thing in force, you keep making these premium payments, and here's how much that floor, that minimum guaranteed value, rises over time. of course, they're not going to make that number rise as quickly year to year as what we think in general the stock market might do on average, especially if we don't count fees. Of course, just like a bond is more conservative and has a lower expected rate of appreciation than a stock does for the same company. But nobody would conclude, oh, only a fool would ever buy bonds because stocks outperform them. No, because you know the bond is more conservative. You're more likely to actually get that rate of return, whereas the stock market, that's just a general figure and it's all over the place. So again, I'm not here saying don't ever invest in the stock market. If you want to, fine, know what you're doing. But my point is the more modest one, that it's crazy to say, oh, you can always outperform a whole life policy, just buy term and invest the difference. Both components of that strategy are not equivalent. That the life insurance is not the same. You have less coverage built in because you don't have the continuation value. And on the investment side, it's far riskier than what the life insurance company is guaranteeing you and is promising you in terms of the expected dividends and so forth. So both of those components of that standard demonstration are not apples to apples, and it's really just an illegitimate comparison. So we're not saying don't buy term. For some people, that might be the right thing to do. What we're saying is the standard glib demonstrations by which apparently it's shown that whole life is silly because it's clearly dominated by a buy term, invest the difference. Those demonstrations are completely illegitimate because they're doing apples to oranges, and somebody making that kind of an argument doesn't understand how whole life works.
And Bob, what I want to add to everything you said, which is absolutely correct, is that this slogan, buy term and invest the difference, is so embedded in the mind of so many people because it's been around for a long time. Now, many people attribute it to a slogan that Dave Ramsey created, but that's not the originator of that particular slogan. That is tied to a man by the name of A.L. Williams. And A.L. Williams built up a huge agency in which he sold a lot of term life insurance. But at the same time, in order to sell the term life insurance, he would go to people that had whole life policies. He would convince people that the whole life policy didn't earn very much, get them to cancel that policy and take that cash value and invest it in another side investment business that he had that dealt in mutual funds. And so it created a huge, monstrous organization. And so the agents that were under his organization would go out and they would convince people, you know, cancel that whole life policy, simply buy a much cheaper term policy, take that cash value that which we've been talking about, that surrender cash value that we've been talking about previously. Take that money and invest it in a mutual fund. And here's where you go for that. And it was the other side business that A.L. Williams had. And from that, he grew a powerful, huge agency. And so it's well worth to investigate that. We've written several LMR articles about it. If you're a subscriber, you can go to the archives and find those particular historical accounts, or if you're free and just want to Google A.L. Williams and read as much as you can about it, you'll find that that's true. But it's a powerful slogan, and it makes people say, yeah, oh yeah, I've always heard that you need to buy term and invest the difference. They can't tell you why. They just know that that's all they've ever heard. So I just wanted to mention that or add that to what you just said, because it's a very powerful slogan, and you mostly hear Dave Ramsey say it, and Susie Orman, and lots of people attribute it to these particular people, but no, it dates back before that.
Yes, you're right. I am remembering now those LMR articles where you dug that stuff up. What's fun, folks, for me is that Carlos will go and do research on these topics for the Laura Murphy Report, And then he sends me the draft and I get to see it before any of you do. And like I say, half the time it's something like I had never heard of that before. And I was like, wow, how long did it take you to go look this stuff up, Carlos? So it's very fun to be one half of the team in the Lara Murphy Report. Well, we are certainly over time for this particular episode. So why don't we wrap up there? To remind you folks, the game plan is we're not covering everything in the book chapter here because we want you to buy the book. Where would I do that, Bob? You say, oh, glad you asked. It's thecaseforibc.com is where you can get this book that we're going through in such meticulous fashion. But the big looming questions that were in this chapter that Carlos and I decided we want to devote an entire episode to, and that's what we'll do next episode, has to do with, hey, you know, I'm an Austrian or a fan of the Austrian school. I'm really worried about the economy with what the Fed and other central banks have been doing. I'm worried about inflation. And so why would I, you know, can I trust these life insurance companies? Aren't they going to go down? Or is the, if the dollar's going to crash, then do I really want to get an asset that's denominated in dollar? Those types of questions. And they're very good questions. We get them all the time. So we thought, why don't we go ahead and just devote an entire episode to that? So that's what we're going to do next time. So stay tuned for that. Let me remind you, for this buy term and invest the difference stuff, we have three whole podcast episodes. That's episodes 4, 5, and 6 of the Lara Murphy Show, if you want to go check the archives. All of this stuff, if you're hearing this and you're not sure where our website is, well, it's laramurphy.com. That's LARA-Murphy.com is where you find all this stuff. Last two plugs. Remember, in April, it's going to be, let me just double check the date. I don't want to say the wrong date. Saturday, April 14th of 2018, Carlos and I are both going to be speaking just on broad Austrian topics for the Mises Institute. You go to Mises.org and then their events tab and you can see that information. And then on Saturday, May 19th, 2018, we're going to be speaking in Chicago along with David Stearns, on just IBC, specifically on IBC. So it's for the general public. If you like what you're hearing on this podcast series and want to learn more and get an in-depth experience, that's what that event's going to be for. For information on that, go to ibcseminar.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of the Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Lara Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LaraMurphy.com are not here and engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.